Continuing with 16, we will stay in the books of poetry. As you recall, we have left the historical books and have come to that sharply contrastive set of books, the books of philosophy or poetry, or books of wisdom, Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon. We have considered thus far the books of Psalms and Proverbs. When we left our study of the historical books, we realized that these books were concerned with a nation, while these five books are concerned with individuals and are experiential. The preceding historical books were concerned with the Hebrew race, and these five books of poetry are concerned with the human heart. The previous books were prose, and these five books are mainly poetical. In addition to what I said before about the various types of Hebrew poetry, we must not think that because they are poetical, they are just the product of human imagination. I indicated before in the various designs that we discover in the books of Psalms and Proverbs that God is very active in being a unique creator of beauty in various forms. The term poetical refers only to their form. These books of poetry display real human experience and grapple with profound problems and express bigger-than-life realities. Most especially, they concern themselves with the experiences of the godly amid the varying vicissitudes of this changeful life, which is ours under the sun. The next book that we will consider will be the book of Job. In the book of Job, we see the death of the self-life. Through the fires of affliction and a new vision of God, Job is brought to the end of himself. He finally sees himself as God sees him. The self-life, with its self-goodness and self-reason and self-religion and self-esteem and self-everything, is laid bare and laid low. The man who at first is said to have been the best man on earth, in chapter 1, verse 8, is found at last on his face before God, exclaiming, "I abhor myself in dust and ashes." Job 42:6. Most conservative scholars believe that the book of Job is at least as old as the time of Abraham. Since throughout the book of Job, no reference is made to an established worship system, as we have from the time of Moses forward, it is assumed that the book of Job occurs at least during the patriarchal period. The book of Job transpires in the land of Uz. We are not really certain where the land of Uz is located, and maybe for that reason it can be anywhere, so that everyone who reads the book can associate with it. Many believe the land of Uz is in Arabia. And in Job chapter 1, verse 1, we are introduced to Job, a man that's blameless and upright. He fears God and eschews evil. He has 7 sons and 3 daughters. And chapter 1 continues by saying this man is very, very wealthy. In material possessions, he is not lacking anything. In chapter 1, after introducing us to Job and his various religious practices, the Holy Spirit pulls back the curtain of heaven and allows us to see a conversation which transpires between God and Satan and the sons of God. The Lord addresses Satan in verse 7 when he says, "Where have you been?" And Satan says, "From roaming to and fro about the earth and walking about in it." God now throws down the gauntlet of challenge, and he says, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is no man like him on the earth?" Satan responds, "Does Job fear God for naught or for nothing?" Satan says, "No wonder he worships you, and no wonder he loves and honors you. You've hedged him about. You've protected everything that he has. You've blessed the work of his hands. He's rich, his possessions are multiplying. Is it any wonder that he worships you?" With this statement, Satan casts the greatest calumny at God that has ever been delivered. What Satan really says is, people only love you, God, for what you do for them. There is no man in the earth that loves you for no reason. I believe that Christians today are like that to some extent. We can see it every day. When things are going good, when paychecks are regular, and no bills are overdue, the Christians we meet are happy in the Lord and living the victorious life. But let calamity come or tragedy befall them, and they soon become bitter, oftentimes. And this is what Satan says, that people will only love you when you do something for them. But this cannot be true in every case, can it? And to prove that people will love him just for what he is, God throws down the gauntlet. And God says, go ahead. Everything he has is in your power, but just don't touch him. Satan departs, and tragedy begins to befall Job like a trip hammer. In rapid staccato blows comes the riveting news in verse 15 that the Sabians attacked. And then verse 16, while the servant speaking, fire fell. Verse 17, while he was speaking, the Chaldeans raided. While he was speaking, the house fell in on your sons and daughters. And immediately, boom, 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 these tragic announcements are brought to Job. And one would think that he would curse God and shake his fist, but he tears his robe and he shaves his head and falls to the ground. And in his statement contained in verse 21, he gives the answer to the most profound issue of human existence. Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return. The Lord giveth, and the Lord taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Continuing in the book of Job, we will find that much of the content revolves around the concept of theodicy. Theodicy comes from two Greek words, theos, meaning God, and dike, meaning justice. In other words, how do we vindicate the justice of God in view of his attributes in relation to evil? How can we justify God's holiness and the existence of evil? So, that study is a continuing theme throughout the book of Job. Job has now lost all of his possessions. He is intact physically. Chapter 2 now pulls back the curtain again, and we are privy to another meeting which takes place in the heavenlies. The Lord again addresses Satan, and Satan answers as he did before. God again says, have you considered my servant Job, even though you incited me against him to ruin him without cause? And he's still upright. He still fears God. He still eschews evil, turns away from evil. Satan said, skin for skin, all that a man has he will give for his life. Satan said, no wonder, you haven't touched him physically yet. Put forth your hand and touch his bone and flesh, he'll curse you, God, to your face. God says, okay, behold, he's in your power, but you can't touch his life. Satan goes out from the presence of God, and he smites Job with boils from the sole of his feet to the crown of his head. And Job sits out on the ash heap and scrapes himself with a potsherd. A potsherd is a piece of broken pottery, and it was the only thing available to scrape the scabs from his body. And his wife came out, and she saw him sitting there. And she said, how can you hold fast to your integrity, to your faith? Curse God and die. We find at this point that his integrity is firm, but later on in the book, he'll begin to question and challenge God and vacillate between despair and trust. He responds and says, you're a foolish woman. And verse 10 says, Job did not sin with his lips. Job has three friends, and they have just heard of his calamity. I believe that the three friends of Job were righteous, as was Job. Remembering from our study of the imprecatory Psalms what the mentality of the Eastern mind was in this period of time, anyone who suffered as Job has just been suffering must have sin in his life, because that is the reason God has judged him so severely. Because if Job were righteous and had no sin in his life, this would not be happening. We know differently because we have been witness to these two conversations. Job has not been witness to these two conversations, and he will go through the entire book and never find out why this happened. His three friends have not been privy to this conversation in heaven, and they do not know why this is happening. In their eyes, Job must be a sinner. Their position and their theology is shaken to the bone. Their Oriental Eastern reasoning is shaken to the bone, because they believe that if Job is righteous and this has befallen him, then they are open game for anything that can befall them. Unless they can prove that Job has sin in his life, then their total concept is destroyed. And the same thing that's happening to Job could happen to them the very next day, the very next week, the very next month. So for that reason, they must discover the sin that Job has in his life to vindicate their position and their theology. At least when they come and lift up their eyes at a distance, they don't even recognize him. They raise their voices and they weep and they tear their robes and they throw dust over their heads. And this is typical Oriental mourning. They sat down on the ground for 7 days and 7 nights, and no one spoke a word. Do you know anyone that you would sit with for 7 days and 7 nights? Do you know anyone that would sit with you for 7 days and 7 nights because they grieved with you and for you? I cannot recall that this has ever happened in my lifetime. This was a different way of living, a different lifestyle, a slower pace when people really cared about people. Sometimes my heart longs for a return to that kind of personal relationship with people. In their own way, they cared about Job, and they demonstrated their concern and compassion by sitting with him there in the ashes for 7 days and 7 nights and never saying a word. Beginning in chapter 3, we will have the series of dialogues that will continue through chapter 41, verse 34. It is important to realize now the structure and nature of the book of Job from this point forward. We have a small knit group of Eastern sheikhs, or princes of the East, sitting in typical Eastern fashion and discussing the verities of life. Beginning in chapter 3, Job begins to curse the day he was born, and we can see that in chapter 3, Job's state of mind is the lowest that it will ever be during the entire book. His statements such as, "Let the day perish when I was born," verse 3, verse 11, "Why did I not die at birth?" Verse 20, "Why is light given to him who suffers?" So Job breaks the 7-day silence with his dialogue in chapter 3. The motif of the book begins in chapter 4, and it will be a continuing cycle of speeches. Eliphaz will speak, and then Job will give his retort. Bildad will speak, and then Job will give his response. Zophar will speak, and Job will respond. Then Eliphaz, Job, Bildad, Job, Zophar, Job, Eliphaz, Job, Bildad, Job, and then everything begins to break down, and Zophar doesn't respond. And the communication deteriorates at that point. Throughout the continuing cycle of speeches, each man is attempting to discover what's wrong in Job's life, and it's like a thrust and parry, thrust and parry, and they are sparring between dialogues. Eliphaz begins in chapter 4 and in effect says, do you give it out and can't take it? In verse 3 he says, you've strengthened many, you've admonished many, you've strengthened weak hands. And in verse 5, now it touches you, it comes your way and you're dismayed. What he really says is, it's about time for you to practice what you preach, Job. Verse 7 now says, whoever perished being innocent, where were the upright destroyed? And this summarizes the Oriental reasoning that no one perishes being innocent, and upright people are never destroyed. Eliphaz continues in verse 12 and uses an age-old method to impress other people of his religious authority. What is that? He refers to an occult experience. Does this method sound familiar? Now a thing was secretly brought to me, and mine ear received a little thereof. In thoughts from the visions of the night, when deep sleep falleth on me, fear came upon me, and trembling, which made all my bones to shake. Then a spirit passed before my face. The hair of my flesh stood up. It stood still, but I could not discern the form thereof. An image was before mine eyes. There was silence, and I heard a voice saying, shall mortal man be more just than God? Shall a man be more pure than his maker? With this concocted story of an occult spiritist type experience, Eliphaz attempts to justify his argument and add validity to his claim. He continues in chapter 5 with his accusation of Job. Verse 17, behold, how happy is the man whom God reproves. So don't despise the discipline of the Almighty. Verse 27, he says, we have investigated it, thus it is. Hear it and know for yourself. And with this, he gives the source of his great wisdom. We've checked it all out, Job. This is how it is. Chapter 6, Job laments, and when Job answers, he doesn't answer so much against Eliphaz this time, but he continues to vent his anguish and his remorse over his current situation. Job continues in chapter 7 and beginning in verse 11, he unleashes a series of rhetorical questions. He cannot hold back and begins to complain with all the bitterness of his soul. Following this complaint and the venting of his anguish, Bildad picks up the dialogue in chapter 8 and accuses Job of producing nothing but a big wind. How long wilt thou speak these things, and how long shall the words of thy mouth be like a strong wind? Verse 20 says, lo, behold, God will not cast away a perfect man, neither will he help the evildoers. Therefore, Job, you must be a wicked person, or God wouldn't be treating you this way. Job responds in chapter 9, and in a way gives sarcastic agreement. He continues throughout chapter 9 with his retort to Bildad. Finally, in chapter 10, he says, I loathe my own life, and continues in the depths of depression until chapter 11, Zophar, takes up Job's challenge and says, Job, you talk too much. Shall a multitude of words go unanswered, and shall a talkative man be acquitted? We'll answer you. The summary of Zophar's argument is in chapter 11, verse 13. If thou prepare thine heart and stretch out thine hands toward him, if iniquity be in thine hand, put it far away, and let not wickedness dwell in thy tabernacles. For then shalt thou lift up thy face without spot. Zophar joins Eliphaz and Bildad in accusing Job of harboring iniquity in his heart. Job's lament and response continues on through chapter 14 until in chapter 15, Eliphaz picks up again and we have the start of the second cycle of speeches. Eliphaz, as he responds in chapter 15, verse 1, is no longer courteous like he was in chapter 4, verse 2, because now Eliphaz says that Job is just full of hot air. In chapter 15, verse 2, he says, "Should a wise man utter vain knowledge and fill his belly with the east wind? Should he reason with unprofitable talk?" Eliphaz joins the others in his disdain of Job. He says, "You weren't the first man to be born. Why do you harbor wisdom to yourself?" In verse 7, verse 8. "What do you know that we don't know? And what do you understand that we don't understand, Job? You don't have all the answers." And Eliphaz begins to rebuke Job severely. Job responds in chapter 16. In a word, Job says, "I'm sick of all the prattle, all this useless talk you're giving me. Should vain words have an end? I also could speak as you do if your soul were in my soul's stead. I could heap up words against you, and I could shake my head at you." He says, "I wish the tables were turned. I wish you were here and I was there. Then I could say the kinds of things that you're saying. But unfortunately, I'm here and you're there. And I'm tired of all the useless talk. It's not helping me. It's not doing any good." Chapter 16 demonstrates Job now, after a few speeches which contain some high thoughts and elevated ideas, he begins to sink back now into despair, because in chapter 17, verse 1, Job says, "My breath is corrupt, my days are extinct, the graves are ready for me," and he's ready to die. He's distressed, and he begins to lament his state once again. But Bildad picks up in chapter 18, and he shows no patience with Job. Beginning in verse 5, he enumerates the horrible fate of the wicked. But Job responds in chapter 19, and after the crushing burden of the heavy words of his friends, he begs for pity. He says, "How long will you torment me? How long will you crush me with words? Even if I've truly erred, my error lodges with me. Help me." When he finds no pity, he cries the words recorded in verse 25. "For I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And although after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God." Tremendous prophecy of the coming Redeemer. The Hebrew word here is the same as we discovered in the book of Ruth. The word is the Goel. "I know that my Goel liveth." Whichever translation we put on that word, Redeemer is fine. "He who will buy me back will ransom me." We can also use Vindicator or Defender or Avenger. And certainly in the current situation where Job finds himself now, he needs all of these things. He needs an avenger. He needs a vindicator. He needs a redeemer. He needs a defender. Following this outburst, Zophar is angry. Job responds to Zophar's angry outburst in chapter 21 and says, "You're all wrong." Following Job's defense of his philosophy and theology in chapter 21, the third cycle of speeches begins in chapter 22, and Eliphaz unleashes a scathing accusation. He gives a detailed catalog of sins which he believes that Job committed in verses 4 through 9, and summarizes his argument with verse 29. Job's response to this takes chapter 23 and 24. Then in chapter 25, Bildad has a very short dialogue because the communication between the group has broken down. It has deteriorated into arguments ad hominem and accusations and slanderous remarks. So Job responds in chapter 26 and then pauses at the end of chapter 26 as if he is waiting for Zophar to come in, because so far, Eliphaz has had three speeches, Bildad has had three speeches, but Zophar has only had two speeches. But Zophar does not respond after chapter 26 to complete the cycle. So Job begins again in chapter 27, because chapter 27:1 says, "Moreover, Job continued." Evidently, when Zophar did not finish up the cycle as it had been. In chapter 28, Job cannot reconcile his suffering with his integrity and turns his mind to the wisdom of God. And although he seems to be at the end of his rope, he bursts forth with a beautiful poem. The poem is contained in chapter 28. Chapter 29 contains Job's final oath, and in a way he wishes for the good old days. Job says in chapter 29, verse 2, "Oh, that I were as in months past, as in the days when God preserved me." Oh, how Job longs for the days of old, when his children were around him, when his servants met his needs and he had food and good health. But those days are gone, and the reality is he's sitting on the ashes, and his friends have reviled him. In chapter 30, he has to realize that the current reality of the situation is that now those that are younger than he is mock him. And he said, "I cry to thee for help, but you do not answer me," in verse 20. Finally, in chapter 31, Job initiates the ancient Near East final proof of honesty, because he calls down God to curse him if he's guilty. This method of self-incrimination or self-exoneration in Job's culture was more meaningful than swearing before a jury, because in this kind of situation, the punishment for perjury against God held more terrifying consequences than perjury before a human jury. As he categorizes the different activities for which he wishes judgment if he has been guilty, these are in specific answer to the listing of sins by Eliphaz in chapter 22, of which he believes Job to be guilty.